Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to have one of my personal heroes, Alice Chandler, with us today. Alice Chandler was president of the SUNY New Paltz campus from 1980 to 1996, presiding over a period of transformational change. She has also served as acting president of the City College of New York, CUNY, and Ramapo College of New Jersey. She was the first woman elected by her peers to serve as chair of the AASCU, American Association for State Colleges and Universities, the leading voice for public regional colleges and universities. She has also chaired the Commission on Women of the American Council on Education, ACE, was a co-chair of the Commission on the Future of State Colleges and Universities, and served on the National Commission on Minority Participation in American Life. She holds honorary degrees from Ramapo and Kane University. Chandler has been awarded the Marita Houlihan Prize for International Education and has written extensively about foreign student policy. She has lectured in China and Turkey, among a number of other countries, and was among the first Americans to greet Andrei Sakharov when he was released from the internal exile in what was then the Soviet Union. Chandler is the author of 11 books and monographs. Her book, A Dream of Order, An Examination of Victorian Political Ideals, has been translated into Japanese. Her 1998 study, Public Higher Education and the Public Good, showed how unaffordable college was for lower and middle income students even then, a problem which has only grown more acute over time. On a personal note, Alice Chandler asks that I mention her wonderful husband, two wonderful sons, their wonderful wives, and six even more wonderful grandchildren. Welcome, Alice Chandler.
Hi, Alan.
I understand that you once were talking to somebody at SUNY at New Paltz, and they said, this guy Chartok, he's up in Albany, and he runs the Legislative Gazette, and you said, he'll bear watching. He'll bear watching.
Well, you know,
one of my favorite quotes of all times.
Well, it cuts two ways, you know. But I think at the time I was thinking, that sounds like a great idea. And I must say, after how many years has the Legislative Gazette been going on?
Oh, it's certainly in the mid-30s.
I would think so. Well, yeah. Congratulations on a job well done over a long period of time.
Alice Chandler, let's start at the beginning. You are a woman of great fortitude. In fact, I mentioned on a recent program and then heard from you that you sort of reminded me a little bit of Maggie Thatcher. A woman who knew her own mind. And to this day, when I announced that you were a transformational president at New Paltz, it is so true, because that's where I was saying it. What happened to turn New Paltz around was the question that somebody asked me. And I said, well, we had this wonderful woman. She knew what she wanted. She knew what she wanted to do. And while I didn't say it on the radio, I'll say it here, she didn't take any crap. Where did you get that fortitude? Was it bred into you at home?
Well, remember, I'm a child of the Depression, so I grew up living with economic hardship. I'm also, I realize, pretty much a first-generation American. My father was an immigrant. My mother was the first in her family to be born in the United States. So I grew up believing that the United States was a world of opportunity, but also it was a world of opportunity for people who worked hard and had the courage to stand by their convictions.
So how did it work in your family? What did your father do?
My father was a pharmacist. He had a pharmacy in a poor neighborhood where he was essentially the primary care physician. People would come in, there was no health care then, of course. They would come in literally with their hands shaking, with a prescription in their hands, because they didn't know how much it was going to cost for the prescription to be filled. I mean, they'd already paid $2 to the doctor.
And where was the neighborhood?
It was Brownsville in Brooklyn.
Interesting. And your mom, did she work or did she keep the house?
No, my mother worked. She was the administrator for a small, it was a private school, but it was called a progressive school in those days because it followed the philosophy of John Dewey to learn by doing, a lot of emphasis on actual experience.
And where was that?
That was on Prospect Park West, in a wonderful old building that looked exactly like Hogwarts School in Harry Potter.
That's great. And how did she receive the education that she needed in order to do that work?
Well, that's an interesting story. She did elementary school and high school, which were standard in those days, though not everybody finished. Then she wanted college. And would you believe that my great uncle came by ferry from New Jersey to tell my grandfather, don't let her go to college. No one will marry her.
Wow. But she met a college man and married him.
They each had post-secondary education.
Uh-huh.
Sure, that's right.
Uh-huh. Interesting. What do you remember the life lessons that they taught you?
Well, I think the life lessons were that you really had to focus on education. I mean, I heard that from everyone, even from my grandmother, which was it was very important to go to school, to do well in school. I think there was partly a vocational sense that, yes, you could get a job, probably as a teacher. But more than that, there was also a kind of magic to education, that you knew someplace, that you took your place in society, and that it granted you what was very important was the ability to be a cultured person. And for that generation, that was very important.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Barnard. That's the Women's College of Columbia University.
Tell us about it. You know, your mother was an important person in Dewey. There was a man named, I guess, Kirkpatrick from Columbia, who was a progressivist in the Dewey tradition. You went to Barnard. Mm-hmm. What were you impressed by or not impressed by at Barnard?
Aside from friends, and I think college, and particularly if you have the privilege of living in a residential college, friends become all important. Faculty become role models. But I would say Barnard's greatest strength as an institution was the focus it paid to the life of the mind, and particularly to the notion that you really had to know something about the subject, that you couldn't just make it all up. And so if you were an English major, as I was, it meant you really read the text, you knew what was in the text, you knew the historical background of the text. And that was conventional in those days. But Barnard, I think, put a very strong emphasis on it.
How important was, you know, an all-women's college, which it was in those days?
Well, there were no such things. I mean, most of the women's colleges were single-sex, and most of the Ivy League male colleges were single-sex. I think it did give you a sense of confidence. It meant that there were no more assertive males in class raising their hands. I'm not sure if I had to do it over again in today's environment, whether I would choose a women's college or whether I would go to a coeducational institution.
What do you think you might have lost? That's an interesting point. I mean, in other words, look, you've achieved miraculous things in your life. And so what do you think you could have possibly gotten if you didn't go to a single-sex college?
I think I might have been in a more combative environment.
You?
I am really a meek, mild grandmother who bakes cookies.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
don't understand me, Alan.
We all understood. There was no fight you didn't get involved in if you thought it was right. And somewhere you learned to do that. Okay, so was there one professor you particularly hated at Barnard?
Yes, I will not repeat his name, although he is long gone from this earth, but it was the man who made me memorize the 11 provisions of the Treaty of Westphalia in something 16-something or other.
Memorize,
yes. You would then take a test and be asked things like, what were the 11 provisions of the Treaty of Westphalia?
Wow. Have you always been good at memorization?
I was then. Years have passed now, but I could still recite Anglo-Saxon poetry to you.
Fascinating. You know, Yo-Yo Ma, who I did a recent interview with, said, if you learned it between 16 and 24, you'll remember it forever. But later on, it gets harder.
I think that's true. My theory is just that the disk has gotten cluttered, the memory disk.
Yeah, it gets clouded. Certainly mine has. So I want to ask you, what happened after college?
After college, I worked for a year as the associate editor of an economics magazine. I had never taken an economics course, mm-hmm. and I wrote a column of economic predictions, which were pure fantasy, but I copied them from all the best journals around.
And have you gone back and looked at those ever to see how much what you said turned out to be right?
You know, that's interesting. I think I would have to go to the deepest levels of the closet, however, and I'm not even sure I have copies anymore.
I'm not trying to get to your age, but give us a general idea about what was going on in the world while you were graduating from college.
Well, I was graduating from college. The UN was newly formed. We were about to, if we weren't already, my dates are fuzzy now, have war in Korea.
Sure.
Television was becoming a big thing. Well, that's what comes to the top of my mind.
Sounds like you and I are contemporaries.
No, Alan, but okay, thank you.
When did your family get its first television?
I would say sometime around 1950.
Interesting. We beat you by a year. but only because Sylvia Astro got mean to the Chartok twins, and my mother thought she had to compete about who had a television in the building, and that's how we got one. So what motivated your parents to get one?
I think everybody had it. I'm wondering if we got it in time for the 1948 election, but I don't think so, because I remember listening to election discussions and returns on radio. I don't remember doing it on TV.
And what were the politics of your parents, and did those politics transfer to you?
Oh, my parents were very staunch New Deal Democrats, and the answer to that is yes.
Yes, they did transfer to you.
Absolutely.
As life has gone on, have you ever been disappointed with Democratic positions?
I would say with reasonable frequency, but on balance, I stayed with my early viewpoints and my early political preferences.
Very interesting. So let's move on. And you were there at the Economics magazine. And then what happened?
Then what happened? One of my old faculty members from Barnard said there's a job teaching English at Skidmore College up in Saratoga Springs, and we've recommended it for you. So I went up. I think I was 22 at the time.
Now, you didn't have a master's.
I did. I had just completed my master's degree.
At
Columbia University.
At Columbia, okay.
And I went up there. I was not much older than my students. And since we had some returning GIs in the class, mm-hmm. I was actually younger than some of them. And it was a wonderful experience because that sort of youth meets youth combination meant that there was very little barrier in terms of the distance between myself and my students. And we had lively, wonderful discussions. And it was a very good beginning teaching experience for me.
And you lived in Saratoga.
I lived in a little apartment at the back of somebody's house in Saratoga Springs and didn't have a car and walked to work in the snow.
What did you learn about education in that first class at Skidmore?
Well, I learned that you really had to be conscious of what your students were learning. I was teaching a course in American literature, and I guess I was lecturing too much. And I thought I was just doing a brilliant job because, you know, anything I had to say about American literature was very worthwhile listening to. And I had a student come into my office and practically explode that, you know, she didn't understand a word that I was saying and nobody understood a word that I was saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was hurt and somewhat angry at the time, but it was actually a good lesson. And I learned to be much more aware, first of all, of the need to bring people in, but also of the symptoms of their not being engaged. It's what I used to call the shuffle quotient. You know, if you heard the feet shuffling too much, you knew you had lost your class.
And you changed your ways as a result of that?
I think moderately. I mean, I think that I was probably meeting with an exaggerated student response from a student who was perhaps overexcited, but I also did change my ways. And, you know, you just sort of come to feel the audience response. I think you can do it even, as has happened to me, with fairly large audience groups.
Sure.
You suddenly realize you've got to shift voice or do something to shift focus.
Okay, how long did you stay at Skidmore?
Oh, only 1 year. Okay. Because it wasn't that Skidmore and I didn't get on.
No.
It was that I became engaged.
Well, that's an important part of the story. What happened?
What happened? Well, again, this business of, you know, my students and I were practically contemporaries. I came back on the train one day, and one of my students spotted my engagement ring, and it was all over the campus by the time I turned up on campus the next morning.
Well, tell us about this whole part of your life. I mean, who'd you meet? What happened?
Well, I met a man named Horace. He's a chemical engineer with a degree from Cornell University.
Where'd you meet him?
Where did I meet him? I met him at the engagement party of some mutual friends, and he said that he admired me because I was simultaneously holding a teacup with tea, holding a cookie in my hand, and talking with my hands and not spilling the tea.
Well, you went to...
I went to a Seven Sisters Women College.
Exactly.
That was what you did.
Of course. Yeah. So you met him. And then how long did it take to get engaged?
Probably engaged about 3 months later.
Whoa.
But we didn't get married till about 6 or 7 months after that because I had to finish out my year at Skidmore.
Wow. And was there long distance commutation? In those days, you know, it wasn't as easy as it is now.
Well, our deal was that I came down by train one weekend, and then the next weekend he drove up by car.
Yeah, that kind of thing is still going on, you know. I mean, these long-distance relationships. Okay, so 1 year, and then what?
Then I guess I went back to Barnard.
But now you're married.
Now I'm married. No, I know what I did. That was the year I had a fellowship from Columbia University, and I started working on my doctorate.
Ah. And the doctorate was in English, but what was the subject?
My field is Victorian literature. That's 19th century British literature.
Do you see yourself as a Victorian? I mean, if I look at you sometimes, I'm thinking about Queen Victoria. I am.
What, because I am not amused? No, I...
I just want to remind everybody we're talking to one of the great influences on many of our lives who've taught at New Paltz, the president of New Paltz for years, Alice Chandler, who has often been identified as a transformational leader who turned New Paltz into what is now one or two of the most difficult to get into universities in the SUNY system. And I have to say, I gave a talk once in which I got hell for, in which I said when I first came to New Paltz in 1970, around 70, 71, full-time, if you could breathe on a mirror, you could get in. And they resented that. And then somebody said to me, so what happened? I said, then we got Alice Chandler. She turned things around. But we'll talk more about that. But let's go back to your career and what happened. And that is, you're now doing a doctorate in Victorian literature. And what was your subject?
Well, this will put your audience to sleep. Victorian medievalism, which is the study of the Middle Ages during the 19th century that had very little to do with the Middle Ages as they actually existed in history, but were really, really concerned with a kind of idealized vision of the Middle Ages as a time when reciprocal relationships between masters and workers, between landowners and farmers and tillers of the soil, showed a mutual caring. And it was put up, there was a virtue to it in that it put up these ideals, and they were dreams. I called the book A Dream of Order. They put up this idealized society against the industrial age that everyone read about in their civics courses, you know, women toiling in the mines, children working 14 hours a day in cotton mills, and terrible, terrible urban slums. And so this vision, which was, you know, seemingly very esoteric, eventually finds its way into the politics of Victorian Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli, and from him into some of the late 19th century changes in British social policy. Your readers might be interested, or listeners might be interested to know, that it's as early as 1906 and 1907 that the British put in things like nationalized health care and a nationalized social security and unemployment insurance system.
Interesting, because I always think that post-Churchillian, the Labour Party that ousted Churchill always took that credit for the national health system, but I'm sure you're right.
Well, it was greatly expanded, and I don't want to bore everyone. Essentially, it was a financing system that you got money. The other thing, of course, was that to go to the doctor in 1906 was usually not very productive of results.
Yeah, they bled
medical,
you.
That was about the size of it. But anyhow, you had a government compensation for lost work and things like free tuberculosis screening, which was important in that society.
Did you publish the book? I mean, it was a dissertation. Does it become a book?
It got published by a scholarly press, and as a matter of fact, almost a little bit, was said to have started a whole new area of Victorian studies.
But it was political, if you think about it, as you suggest. You're writing in English, but you're pointing out that even the way in which the Victorians portrayed this stuff was, you know, myth.
Exactly, exactly.
Fascinating. Okay, so now you're off to the races. You have a PhD. You're married to Horace, who is a wonderful man, may I say. And now what happens?
Well, I do some teaching. I teach at what was then called Hunter in the Bronx, which is now Lehman College.
A college, I may say proudly, I went to and graduated from.
I didn't know that, Alan.
See,
and I
these,
think
are
that's
great these are great opportunities for learning. And once I was stopped by a policeman, and he said, where'd you steal the car from? And I said, what do you mean steal the car? He says, everybody knows Hunter, because it had a Hunter sticker on the back. Everybody knows Hunter is a girls' school. I said, not in the Bronx.
That's marvelous. Well, actually, I guess what I'm also doing is I am working on my PhD at that point.
Yeah.
And I have my first child in 1957 and my second child in 1960.
So as a feminist, which you are, how was that? I mean, did you feel you had a greater load than you would have had if you were a man? Because after all, you had to take care of the kids and you also had to teach.
Possibly. I had a very supportive husband. I had a helpful mother, and I don't need much sleep. And that's a very good combination if you want to try to do all these things at once.
So you're teaching a couple of courses, you're having these kids, but when does the career really take off?
I would say that the career start for me is going to teach at City College, CCNY, in 1961. Mm-hmm. I have a child of 4 and another baby of 11 months. I'm going to CCNY teaching 3 composition courses, 1 literature course, and loving it.
All at the same time? For a semester?
For a semester.
Wow.
For a semester, Alan. It was another world.
It was another world.
But Alan, I was paid $3,600 a year to do this.
That's a lot.
Small fortune.
Remember, a Coke cost a nickel. No.
True.
So you start to teach, but you have a little bit of a political bent, don't you?
Well, actually, at that point in my life, no. I must say, at that point, I am happy to keep my head above water because I am teaching 4 courses. I do have 3 comp courses with an essay every week that has to be read.
People don't remember those things. You have a tremendous amount of grading to do.
There was an enormous amount of grading, and I was exceedingly conscientious about it. So that, you know, the amount of ink I put on the page was very likely to almost equal the ink that was sent to me. By the way, in those days, it taught you good deciphering skills. Many kids didn't have typewriters, and the computer had not yet been invented, the word processor.
Oh, indeed. Greatest thing that ever happened to me.
And to me, too.
And so, interesting, because at Hunter, by the time I got there, you had to type the themes. You had to fold them in the middle. And the guy looked at us and he said, "One mistake and you're out." In other words, one spelling error, you're out. I mean, I still have nightmares about them. Were you tough too?
I never did that, but I would obviously, you had to grade the papers and
sure.
The grading would be a combination of both, you know, what you had to say and how well and accurately you said it. But it was also a learning experience. What interested me with the students in these freshman comp courses was that someplace around halfway through the term, most of the students finally got what they were supposed to do, which was to take an idea, state it, and then essentially prove it, essentially document it, describe it, rebut possible arguments, make it a coherent statement. And it was just fascinating. It was sort of like watching a light bulb go on.
But of course, City College, with more Nobel laureates, I think, than anyone, had recruited a bunch of very bright young people.
That's very true.
So now you have this experience. Bring us on to the next phase of this. You had to get tenure. Was that hard?
I did get tenure. Well, it was interesting and a sign of sort of what I think are the hidden biases which existed then and to some degree still do. I was practically the only woman to get tenure. There was 1 year where I think there were 6 women coming up for tenure. That may have been my year, Alan, if I don't have this exactly, the spirit is correct. And 5 out of 6 were just let go. And there were statements. I remember having a statement relayed to me by someone who'd overheard it. Well, you know, the women just don't care as much about the department as the men do. Which statement outrages me to this day.
Were you a member of the union?
Yes, I was in those days. I have had the interesting experience of sitting on both sides of the table.
Because my mother had a very good friend named Bell Zeller, who claims that she was in the room when the Shartok twins were born. But I don't know. I don't know if it was a little excessive or not. However, it's interesting that the head of the union was a woman.
Bell Zeller was a legend in her day. I mean, she was a remarkable woman. And at that point, I think that the work she did was really outstanding and well called for. In the sense that policies and procedures were very ad hoc and at random. And while sitting on the other side of the table as somebody who was, you know, listening to unions and their grievances, I, you know, could frequently find myself saying, this is outrageous or this is ridiculous. Having sat on both sides, I know that the union did help, one, to bring wages up beyond $3,000 a year or whatever it was, and secondly, were among the forces that forced colleges to regularize their procedures so that they were less personalized.
So let's just get this straight. Unions, because of those days, I mean, you know, they were taking on massive, you know, inequalities, mm-hmm. were really called for. I do know that Bell Zeller gets a lot of credit because she was able to convince the legislature, as I remember it, to say that, okay, and a full professor was getting the money of a deputy superintendent in the Board of Education and downward. Uh-huh. So that really did, as you say, bring salaries up significantly. But that later on, some of these things became a little bit petty. I mean, I remember something at New Paltz when you were there that was extraordinary. I had a part in it. I probably shouldn't announce this now, but somebody gave you testimony that one of your professors had admitted on the stand to selling drugs to his own students. And you saw the trial testimony. You summarily called him in and you fired him. And he said, you can't, because the deal I made with the FBI for turning evidence against the other guy, another guy, was that I couldn't be fired. He said, well, they can keep you out of jail, you said, allegedly, but they cannot prevent me from firing you for this. We'll play it out on the front pages of the newspapers if you want to. And the guys in black suits actually showed up in your office. How much of that can you verify?
Alan, either my memory has failed or this story has gained in drama. But the nubbin of that story was that there was a faculty member who was involved in illicit drug sales, whether on behalf of the FBI or not. I won't go in that direction.
Yeah, no, I remember pretty well, yeah.
Okay, you probably remember it even better than I do. What I do want to emphasize, though, Alan, was this was not my personal whim or action, that in any case where you're going to let somebody go, particularly if you're letting go a tenured professor, there are very, very detailed procedures that must be followed mm-hmm. all along the line. You can't simply arbitrarily say, I don't like what you did, goodbye.
But you did it. You went through the procedure.
We went through the procedures, and what my memory tells me, that they were extraordinarily complex, involving, you know, legal teams on both sides.
We're talking to Alice Chandler, one of my heroes, and I just gave you one reason why. She was the former president of SUNY at New Paltz, called a transformational leader, the person who turned that college around, till the point is, at this stage of the game, it is now one of the first or second most selective SUNY campuses to get into, and that is really saying something. All right, let's go back to the history. So now you're at City College. You are a union member at the time. You've gotten tenure. And then what happens?
What happened was that I got a call one evening from a colleague of mine. Would I like to serve on the Faculty Senate Executive Committee? I said, what's that? He said, oh, you'll like it. You work with the president and you get to know what's going on. Well, that sounded enticing, so I said, okay, I'll do it. The next night I got a call from him saying, would you like to be chair of the committee? And I said, you know, yes, yesterday I didn't even know what it was. He said, well, I won't tell you what he said that persuaded me, but...
Come on.
Well, how shall I put it? It turned out that if I didn't take it, the meetings were likely to go on at great length, uh-huh. and I wasn't going to be able to go home and give my kids dinner. And since I knew even then that I had the capacity for running an efficient meeting, I said I would do it because it was imperative that I get home and the kids have dinner. So I became chair of the Faculty Senate Executive Committee at a very exciting time in the college's history. The college was still absorbing changes in admissions policy, the so-called open admissions. The president was planning a major fundraising drive in the private sector, which was unheard of in the City University at the time. And so it became, I was chair of the Senate for 2 years. It became one of the most exciting periods of my life.
And what was your rank then? Were you associate professor, full professor? Do you remember?
I think I was an associate professor by then.
Okay. And you mentioned the word. I had it on my list of things to get to, so why not get to it now? open admissions. This is interesting stuff, really interesting stuff, because I know, based on your writings and everything else, that you are committed to giving people who don't have a lot of money a chance at higher education. On the other hand, I don't think you think that what they were doing was doing it right. Is that correct?
Yeah. When open admissions came in, remember, it's a very tumultuous time. It's the time of the Vietnam War. It's the time of student protests on campus. The civil rights movement is coming into full swing. And so it comes in, and you probably remember this, even if you weren't at CUNY at the time, it comes in tumultuously with campus occupations and protest marches and all the rest. The college had gradually been preparing to expand its admissions policy, which was highly competitive at the time, by having preparatory programs. It never had a chance really to put these fully into place.
Let's just set the stage and remind everybody, we're now talking about the City University of New York, but the City College, the sort of apex of the CUNY system, which, you know, as I've said before, produces more Nobel Prize laureates, I think, than anybody, maybe not Harvard, but than anybody. And so now you better explain to everybody what open admissions was.
Open admissions was a policy which said, as I recall it, that if you were in the top half, it was never open in the sense that anybody could come in who had a high school diploma. I believe you had to be in the top half of your class. I may be wrong because this is now 30 years back, but I think I'm close to being correct. The problem was, and it's a problem to this day, that many of the high schools to which students went were inadequate to providing the education, the preparatory, college preparatory education that they needed. I mean, I know because I taught freshman English both before and after open admissions. And before open admissions, it was not necessarily a walk in the park. There were a lot of things students didn't know that they should have known. After open admissions, however, you frequently dealt with students who had perhaps never had a writing assignment or very few writing assignments in their entire high school career. I mean, I was constantly surprised by what they had not been taught and therefore could not be expected to know. That there were bright kids in there, you know, I can remember vividly, I remember some of the students that I had who were so gifted, that they came in poorly prepared. I also remember that they faced obstacles that were not necessarily going to be life-changing for middle-income or upper-income students was also true. A student, very smart student of mine, who had to go back to Puerto Rico, his mother who was there got sick. Another student whose father lost his job, and so she had to go to work. I mean, you had this always in City College, because it always dealt with students from frequently impoverished backgrounds. But now this was accentuated by poor high school preparation and perhaps even more dramatic personal circumstances.
I was teaching at John Jay, I think, during that period for 1 year before I came to New Paltz. And as I remember it, there was a policy that you couldn't fail anybody. You could just withdraw them from your course. So I remember this quite well and had some of the same experience that you're recounting now. But there must be people who think, well, you know, everybody deserves a chance. Why not let everybody in? Because after all, the more selective you get, the more, you know, you're just sort of saying to people who come from adverse situations that they can't go to college.
That's such a complicated question. I'm trying to think what pieces I can take out from there to answer.
Thanks for your charity. For you. I appreciate it.
Okay. It seems to me that what you want is a system that works all the way. You want a system where you don't start out behind. You don't start out behind because you're impoverished, because you're malnourished, because you're living in adverse circumstances. You want to have educational systems at the primary and secondary levels that are equal. You then, however, need to have multiple pathways, I think. I think, for example, that community colleges form an extraordinarily useful path for many students who are simply not academically as well prepared as others might be, or who are looking for more technical careers than the typical liberal arts-oriented college would give them. I think you also have colleges, and I would say this is true of New Paltz, colleges which evolve sort of their own ethos. New Paltz at this stage, but it's taken since the early 1980s to go there has gone back to being a highly selective college. I think it only accepts about 40% of the students who apply. Those students match the academic programs, those students match the faculty, and those students work well with each other. What New Paltz has always had, though, is a very inclusive educational policy, admissions policy. It has gone out of its way to bring students from underserved neighborhoods and underserved minority groups to campus to encourage them to apply. It has one of the largest educational opportunity programs in the state, and also one of the most successful. I mean, there was a point, I don't know if it's true today, but back in the early 80s, when I first came, we actually saw our EOP, as they're called, students finishing their freshman year at the same rate as students who were regularly admitted. Now, I don't know if that still holds true, but I know that EOP still has a very high graduation rate. And if you look at what its graduates are doing, you shouldn't be astonished, but you may be, to see the positions they've reached.
Okay, so I want to go back to history, and I want to find out about, okay, so now you're the head of this committee, faculty committee, and you like it, and it gives you a taste, there's a question here, gives you a taste for administration?
It gives me a taste for knowing how things work, and also, I think, for having an inkling, and I don't think it's more than an inkling at that point, that maybe you could do something to make things better. At that point, I am approached by the president, a brilliant physicist named Robert Marshak, and he asks me if I will serve, oh, I guess it was an assistant vice president, for what they called institutional advancement, which is a euphemism for fundraising. The college is about to go out and raise an unprecedented $25 million in the private sector. And I think he believed that because of my faculty connections, I could help bring the faculty along in this endeavor.
So don't leave us in suspense.
I said yes. At that point, we had hired a private fundraising firm. After a couple of months, I came to him because we were paying the firm what was then a small fortune and said, you know, I think I could do this if you just gave me one additional staff member, that we really don't need that whole apparatus. And I guess he had faith in me, or else the bills were just mounting up too much. He said, okay. And so we did, over a two-year period, raise what I believe was $25 million in external funding.
These are people who had graduated, in large part alumni and others who...
A large part alumni, many of whom were quite
successful.
Wealthy.
Yeah.
We also obviously had private foundations funding us. We also had well-meaning citizens who just thought that what City College was doing was well worth supporting.
Now, while all of this was going on, was there still open admissions?
There was still, I believe, I don't know when it exactly changed, taking in 50% of the high school graduates. It eventually changes, and I would be hard-pressed to tell you exactly when.
But Herman Badillo and some of the other guys who had a lot of experience with the City Colleges come in and say, we're not going to do this anymore.
Herman Badillo was, I met him because he was on our board of visitors at the time, and I met him several times. Talk about take no prisoners, people.
Oh, yeah.
He was, for example, opposed to bilingual education. Mm-hmm. We had thought that, you know, this was a kind of transition for students who came from non-English speaking backgrounds, and he was offended. He didn't think that that was something we should do.
Well, you came from a family that was, your father was a pharmacist, your mother was an education person, so you had a little bit of money, but all around you, I remember at Hunter in those days, there were people who had nothing, but who had, you know, really had worked hard, were smart. I take it that's influenced you?
Well, it's funny that you talk about Hunter, because my grandmother spoke very little English, used to read her Yiddish language daily, religiously, and on Sunday they had a photograph section, it was in sepia, it was called Rotogravure. And I can clearly remember her coming to me and showing me this picture of some girl graduate in a cap and gown. And she said, look, that girl graduated from Hunter's College. Someday you'll graduate too.
Okay, believe it or not, we're down to the last 16 minutes of this interview. I can't stand it because it is so important to try to get some of the other stuff at New Paltz that happened. So you're there. Marshak gets you to take this position. And what was the position again, Alice?
It was Assistant Vice President for Institutional Advancement.
Okay. And then what happens?
Then there's this City of New York budget crisis. The then provost and academic vice president, that's sort of the chief manager of the institution, cuts the budget by 25%, fires tenured faculty. Terrible things happen. He leaves. There's a vacancy in the provostship. I'm a candidate for the position.
Provost is number two, for everybody who wants to know. You get the president, then you get the vice president for academic affairs, who's often the provost.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think it's in 1976, I become provost of City College. First woman ever to hold that position. And at the conclusion of this nightmarish budget crisis, I can remember running around all day, simply trying to staff classes. I mean, taking people from under-enrolled courses, sticking them in other courses, whether they knew anything about the subject or not. It was an absolute disaster. I went to sleep every night simply dreaming. I never really slept. I dreamt in FTEs, which is full-time equivalent students. I dreamt in course offerings. And I was provost for 3 years, from 1976 to 1979. In 1979, President Marshak retires, and again, to make a long story short, I become acting president of City College.
Ooh.
Again, first woman in the post.
Were you considered to be a candidate for the job?
I was. It was very clear, for a variety of reasons, including my own lack of experience, that I was never going to be selected for that position. And at that point, the then chancellor of the State University of New York, a wonderful man named Clifton Wharton, it was done by indirection, but I know that it came from him, asked if I didn't want to become a candidate for the presidency of New Paltz. And so I became a candidate, and I guess it was by November or December of 1979, maybe the early spring, that I was offered the position, took the position, finished out my remaining months at City College, and prepared to move into this very new, very different situation.
And because we only have 13 minutes left, what did you find when you got there?
I found a college with, you know how they always talk about tremendous potential? It really did have tremendous potential. It had a very, very good faculty. It had, for the most part, a very solid curriculum. It had a beautiful setting in the Mid-Hudson Valley, but accessible to New York City easily. And it had fallen on hard times.
Because?
Because of a variety of reasons, largely because I think many of the issues of the 1960s, in terms of student behaviors and the general sort of relaxation of standards, had hit the Hudson Valley, which had no experience with these things and took it all very badly.
And they were hanging on. I remember it very well. I arrive in 71, and it was 70-71, and I remember it all. And what do you do about that?
We did a variety of things. For one thing, we did a curricular overhaul and made sure that we had a very strong liberal arts curriculum, because that had gotten very fuzzy and sort of touchy-feely. We closed down some courses that we felt didn't meet the standards for college education.
Like, name one.
We might have had one in wine tasting or something, which is fine. That's a wonderful continuing education course, but not an academic credit.
Right.
And I may be making that one up. You'll get 27 phone calls saying that, you know, we didn't have one. But anyhow, we had courses which I would think that was analogous to. And we said we were going to slightly raise admission standards, which we did. The other thing we did was we created a new disciplinary code for student behavior, which was no more rigorous than anybody else had at the time, but we didn't have one codified. And we disposed of an attitude which said, oh, it's all right, dear. We know you meant well. So that I remember my vice president for student affairs, a terrific guy called Ken Berta, came to me and complained about a student who was sitting outside another student's dorm door all day and all night, banging on nunchucka sticks. Well, we stopped that. We had had no policies that allowed us to stop that before then. I mean, today we would call it harassment, but there were no such criteria then.
So that's when you sort of got the Maggie Thatcher appellation.
Which I take with some modest umbrage. It's a little bit
umbrage.
Like, you know, the
what
hand
I love about you. Yeah, go ahead.
It's a little bit like the iron fist in the velvet glove cliche.
You know, there used to be, previous to you, you know, a while previous to you, there was a guy who, the administration building is named after the Hagerty building. And Hagerty ruled with an iron hand when it was a teacher's college. And my twin brother went there. And he was sort of a martinet. And what happened was that you inherited some of the faculty that had rebelled against Hagerty. And my team, who is wildly for you, sort of called them the Bloomies. And the faculty meetings were wild, and you prevailed. But do you remember all of that?
Yes, Alan, perhaps more than I want to.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a very, it was a suspicion of the administration.
Of authority.
Which was very powerful.
And how do you go to sleep at night when those things are happening? You sort of, as you say, dream about solutions?
Well, as I think I mentioned earlier, I don't sleep all that much. You wake up in the morning, be an early riser. That's the best time to look at problems, at least from my perspective, and see where the solutions might lie. And frequently they don't lie in solving that particular problem, but in finding an alternative strategy which will make that problem go away or be minimized.
So academic politics, are they reprehensible or are they something that you have to be an expert in? What do you want to tell us about that?
I think you have to know the traditions. I mean, there are certain customs and there's a particular culture. But other than that, I don't think it's much different from politics anyplace else. You're looking essentially, if you're a leader, to get a consensus. I used to talk about the broad middle, which is that the broad spectrum of reasonable people will go along with you even if they don't 100% agree because they think on balance this is workable and doable. You will never get the people on the extremes on either side. And if the broad middle is with you, you presumably don't really need their approbation. They can make things very uncomfortable. They can go to the newspaper. They can raise demonstrations. But ultimately, your choices will prevail. And in the long run, the institution will change.
So in your time there, all of a sudden, this becomes a very selective school. Could you sort of measure the change in your own mind? I mean, in other words, did you know it was happening?
Oh, we saw it happening. We originally, our original goal was to have, I think, 25% of our students with averages under 80, and that was regularly admitted students, 50% with averages between 80 and 85, and 25% with averages between 85 and 90. And again, I may have the numbers wrong, but that's the feel of it. And we found within, I think it was only about 2 years, we had lost that bottom tail of students who, whatever their intellectual abilities, were not motivated. They hadn't been motivated in high school, and they were unlikely to be motivated in college. And then I know toward the end of the 1980s, we began to find that we had more applications than any other SUNY four-year college. And that's been going on, way back into the late 1980s, and still goes on today. And then little by little, we began to find that we were among the most selective of the SUNY campuses. I don't know if you saw these figures, but U.S. News and World Report ranked New Paltz sixth among all the colleges in the Northeast and Middle Atlantic, among all the public colleges. It's been ranked number 2 nationally in terms of return on investment, which is not a metric I like, but I quote, which is how much your students earn when they graduate. So it has gotten a very, very different reputation from what it had. And of course, I left in 1996, so it has been the work of other leaders since that time.
My daughter is associate professor of political science at the College of New Jersey, and it's sort of which was named very high in those rankings too, which also did a lot of the transformational work you did at New Paltz, and is now regarded as a very good and important place to get into, and is harder to get into than, I believe, Rutgers and all of the others. So what lesson do we learn from having the guts to do what you did?
I think you do have to have the courage of your convictions. You do have to know what you believe to be right. You do have to be able to persuade a substantial number of people. And that, if you're in a system, includes not only the faculty, which is the governing body to a large degree on campus. you've got to persuade your administrative staff, which means you may have to make some changes in personnel. And in a system like SUNY, you've got to also get the central administration and the board of trustees with you. So it is, I think, a twofold job. It's one, clarifying in your own mind what you think is right to do and what you think you can do over various stages. And then it is a communication and persuasion job of getting people to come along with you. And it requires consistency. It requires consistency even in a crisis, where it is sometimes much easier just to say, okay, I give up, we'll do it what I think is the wrong way, but we will have peace in our time.
Well, details, details. And I can tell you, one of my favorite memories of you is I was coming out of a classroom having just taught. You were coming down the hall, you saw me, and you put your arm through my arm and said, come on, Alan, you're going to the faculty meeting. which I had no intention of doing whatsoever. So there I was. You know, people have tremendous respect for you, Alice. And what I love about you is that while you may have the Maggie Thatcher sort of, you know, you better do this because it's right for you, you also have a sense of humor. And you got to look for it sometime, but it is certainly there. How important is that to you?
I think it's extremely important. It's, first of all, sort of my natural reaction, particularly if anybody makes an overblown statement. But I think just generally, yeah, I think it's a good idea. And I think it's a good idea if you're working with people to keep everything in perspective. And humor does help you do that.
And so when you come down hard on somebody, are there techniques? We only have 3 minutes for cushioning it.
Yeah, I suppose there is. I think one of them, and this is, you know, something I would take credit for having thought through, is to try to depersonalize the issue as much as possible so that it becomes a case of something that has happened or some principle that has been violated. To the extent that you're dealing with a human being, particularly if you're dealing with a student or even a faculty member, because they tend to be sensitive, try not to destroy the personality along with the behavior that you're finding reprehensible.
So if you're having a fight with a faculty member and you say, no, you are going to teach 3 days a week, that's the principle. It has nothing to do with you, but that's what we have laid out, or at least 2 days a week. If I'm understanding you right, you stay with the principle as opposed to you're a lazy, malingering, you know, good for nothing.
The temptation has been there, Alan, but stay with the principle.
Well, I love this conversation. We are out of time. We've been talking with former college president, educator, and author Alice Chandler, one of my personal heroes, the woman who is given huge credit for having turned New Paltz around. Alice, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Alan. Good to talk to you.
I'm Alan Chartok.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.